You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, well, troll on in.
Yep, troll on in and learn some stuff. We're very, very pleased to have from the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, a big, long title, the senior scientist, Dr. Paul Dalzell. I've been here before. Welcome back. And we always seem to have you in, Paul, when there's some explaining that we got to do about what's going on. And a lot of people took a look at what was in the press the other day, and they got all worried because it said ahi fishermen are nearing their quota. And, you know, a lot of people thought, well, that's it. We're not going to be able to get ahi anymore. It actually happens quite a lot, but has it happened this early for a while?
No.
We've been living under a quota since 2009. Mm-hmm. And in 2009, they actually shut the fishery down for 2 days. 2010, that was a big one. You know, they got, what was it, 40-day closure?
Mm-hmm. It was a while, yeah.
Yeah, and it was November, December. So it was that time of the year when, you know, the longline fishermen really hoped to make some big money.
The home run. I mean, it's the big prices and everything else. Now, this happening as early as this means that there's going to be other plans. I don't want people to think they're not going to be able to buy fish. It's just going to be done a little bit differently.
Well, what happens is that people can still fish in the Eastern Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, we mean east of 150 degrees west. It's under the regime of a different international tuna regional management authority.
Okay.
And while we do have some limits there for big boats over 24 meters, mm-hmm. they can only catch up to 500 metric tons, it's unlimited for the rest of our fleet.
Which most of our longline fleet is under that size.
Yes, about 75% is underneath mm-hmm. underneath that size. Now, there's also some boats, I think about 16, that have permits in the American Samoan longline mm-hmm. fishery. As long as they fish on the high seas, they can land their fish into Honolulu.
Okay.
So there will still be Honolulu longline fleet fish coming into the auction. We are working, or National Marine Fisheries Service is working on a measure which will transfer quota from the territories, and this they have in place at a 1,000 metric ton
mm-hmm.
Quota from CNMI. Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands.
I do know, Dr. Dalzell, that there is some controversy about that, and some people that are talking about that's not right. In actual fact, maybe you can explain that the quota was based on not who's taken it or if it's taken, but what the area can sustain. In other words, the number that is somehow agreed upon is to keep this fishery replenished, this is what we can take out of their year. Is that kind of accurate?
Well, one of the things, the West Central Pacific Fishery Commission imposed these limits on us. They imposed limits on the Hawaii longline fleet. But because our territories are like small island developing states, they were unlimited in the amount of big eye that they can catch.
Mm-hmm.
So we as a council did what we think is a responsible thing. We actually put a cap on what the territories could catch, 2,000 metric tons.
Based on what science?
Based less on science, but based on the fact that in the conservation measure,
mm-hmm.
they said if you're catching below 2,000 metric tons, you can catch up to 2,000 metric tons
okay.
already. So we didn't have any long. We didn't have any fisheries in our areas that were catching up to 2,000 metric tons. So we felt that it was precautionary. Again, being a good soldier, good mm-hmm. boy scout, we'll limit our territory fisheries. But we also gave them the provision to negotiate a transfer of 1,000 metric tons mm-hmm. to the Hawaii fleet and that's a private deal that they work out.
Gotcha.
Now, we asked the commission, is this kosher? And as far as they're concerned, it's just it's how we manage our fisheries.
Sure.
It's purely a domestic arrangement.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, I know that there's some people that really don't really get it until it's time to go to the store and buy some fish.
Mm.
And I'm not sure that there's going to be any immediate impact. For those that are listening here on the 1st and 2nd of August, mm-hmm. this is in a couple of days, that area which we're talking about is done. For how long?
Yeah, well, it's 5th of August till mm-hmm. 31st of December.
Okay, so it's done for the year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But if we get the transferability in place, mm-hmm. which we think will happen maybe The most optimistic, mid-September, more likely late September, early October.
So we might have a short period of which there's not as much fish as we'd like to see.
Precisely.
In the market. Yeah.
Precisely.
But what about this? I know that there's a lot of people that are concerned about, maybe NEPA and the enforcement and some of the other things we talk about, that this is pretty well adhered to by our fleet, which is a small fleet.
Mm.
But I understand that there will be others in that area that are fishing and not caring about the restrictions that have been put on us.
Yeah, I mean, we are, you know, as I say, the U.S. Is a lawful country. It follows the rules of law. It follows the rules that are laid down in international conventions and implements them through domestic regulation. But we also have a very environmentally responsible longline fleet.
Sure.
It's the sort of, you know, model icon of what everybody wants when it comes to environmentally responsible longline fishing.
You know what I like about that, and we've talked about it a little bit before, but we should remind everybody as often as possible. Some of the developments about bycatch and about some of the other things, some of the methods that have been developed in our fishery, small as it is enviable. It's to the point where we are exporting not necessarily technology, but science or measures on how to better control what we're taking out of the water.
Absolutely. Our bird and sea turtle mitigation measures are global standards.
Mm-hmm.
If you go and look in the Eastern Pacific, they just take our measures and adopt them.
Yeah.
And they use our measures in the West Central Pacific. And I believe other tuna RFMOs have looked at our measures and used them. And we also have measures, you know, our biggest problem right now is false killer whales. And that's a difficult one to solve. I mean, you know, false killers are as smart as we are.
Is that right?
Yeah. And, you know, we do have a measure in place. We have a take reduction plan. It's probably not to everyone's cup of tea, and it could be improved or tinkered with. But the point is, we're dealing with all elements of bycatch, including estimating how big our fish bycatch is.
Yep.
You know, we have observers 100% on the swordfish vessels, but we only have 20% on the deep-set tuna vessels.
You know, when that comes up, and I've heard that come up before, it's maybe not 100% safe to assume, but if you are looking at the experience of the observation that is going on, multiplying it among the boats that are not having an observer on them, you're just anticipating or hoping that the captains and the crews of those other boats, you know, play by the rules and do whatever's reporting. Do you feel confident about it? Because from the fishermen and some of the skippers and crew guys I've had the opportunity to talk to, everybody's kind of honest. It seems.
Yep.
Anyway.
I think that this is essentially so. I mean, they are even without an observer, they're still monitored.
Mm-hmm.
There's a VMS beacon on there, so we know where they go.
Exactly.
We know when they're fishing.
We're watching you. Yeah, yeah.
We know when they're fishing. Big Brother is watching. Mm-hmm. Then they fill in a log sheet, and that log sheet is checked. Someone goes down to the docks and actually, you know, walks through the log sheet with the skippers, and then whatever comes off that boat, if there had been an observer on the boat, it's checked against the observer's records.
Yeah, so the checks and balances.
And then it finally checked against what comes after the auction. So you got a three-way check of the fish that's been landed by these vessels. So, you know, we have a lot of confidence. And let me say also that there's a very diligent scientist at the National Marine Fisheries Service who has audited these records and can show where, you know, which species have the most error and which species have the least error.
That's why I like, you know, if you take a look at the food chain of all the food we eat, I feel the most confident about fish because everybody knows where the fish, sometimes where the boat, what boat it comes from a lot and where it specifically came from. See, the thing that I think is important for us to try to wrap our heads around is that this technology, I'll give you an example. A couple of weeks ago, I was up visiting Jim Cook and Sean Martin at POP. And they have in their office a couple of monitors where they know where their boats are within a few centimeters on the planet. So that means that the technology has very, very much enhanced our ability to watch each other.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, there's no two ways about it that you can now equip a boat with a variety of monitoring devices apart from VMS. And in fact, I believe that fleets such as in Canada are almost 100%, some fleets are 100% monitered by electronic sensors.
Amazing, huh? Yeah.
You know, they can put a sensor on a reel so they know when it deploys and when it hauls back in again.
Yeah.
And then they have cameras which look at the fish coming over the deck, and they have recognition software. You know, it's kind of like a spin-off of the military, you know, facial ID recognition.
I must tell you that, you know, we've had a tremendous amount of response over the last several months. I've had the opportunity quite often to get some of the guys from Wicked Tuna on the program and interview them, these skippers and these deckhands, these crazy people that are catching the bluefin. And interestingly enough, a couple weeks ago, Dr. Dalzell, we had this guy that was in, it was the Wicked Tuna Outer Banks. And these folks, as much as we think we are observed, they're really observed. I mean, that those buyers of those bluefin, they keep fastidious records, and they are looked at all the time. That's sort of the way it's ended up needing to be, is not for, at least for that fishery.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, bluefin is that, particularly the North Atlantic bluefin, is the most valuable of the tunas. Mm-hmm. It's been, the biomass has been greatly depleted, but you know, you're talking about a fishing fleet, which is basically using recreational angling methods,
exactly,
for commercial purposes, and landing. You know, if you look at the number of fish that they land annually, it's relatively small, so it's not hard to keep. You could keep extremely diligent records on those fish. But just let me say that in Guam, they've had a transshipment industry there for several decades, and they keep very detailed records on what goes through there, and that information, when it was looked at, was actually very, very useful for scientific purposes, in terms of estimating growth rates and other you know, life history parameters for tunas.
Wow. Yeah, that's kind of neat. Well, I think too that one of the things that I've gleaned from that, off the air, talking to some of these guys, is they're not kidding. I mean, there's a lot of drama and you know, stuff in a reality show, but the bottom line is, it is true, and the people most true to it, even it might be begrudgingly because it's money out of their pocket when they have to stop fishing, they seem to collectively get it, that when somebody is operating outside of the boundaries, they get caught.
Yeah. 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 I mean, the I'm not going to speak for the enforcement folks in our fishery. They've got the NOAA Office of Law Enforcement, and you've got the Coast Guard, and they report on the infractions that they find within the fleet. But you know, by and large, I think we have a really responsible longline fleet, and you know, one that's also willing to cooperate with scientists and managers and adapt as needed to circumstances.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I mean, I'm going down there and I look, and it looks like a lot of boats, but it's really not. I don't think that their listener, that most folks really understand, that there are some countries, not even Pacific nations, but some countries fishing in the Pacific very, very efficiently, taking an awful lot of fish out of the water. And it's kind of like piracy on the high seas, if you will. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff going on. Does it concern the scientific community to know that it's very hard to deal with any sort of enforcement on those folks?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the basis of any regulation is how well can you enforce it.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't enforce it, then the regulation is worthless.
Right.
Yeah. We have 100% observer coverage now on purse seine fishing vessels in the Pacific,
which, by the way, is important for those around here to know that it's illegal totally in our waters. It doesn't exist, but it still does in other parts of the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, you can't purse seine in the EEZ around Hawaii, but you could go 1,000 miles south,
right,
you'll find purse seine.
Sure,
and there's a big U.S. purse seine fleet.
What are their target species?
Skipjack and juvenile yellowfin.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's their prime. That's the prime target.
Skipjack meaning aku, folks.
So, aku, I mean, yeah.
Aku that's out there. These purse seiners are taking it out by the poundage that you just can't believe.
2 million metric tons, I think, or 2.5 million metric tons.
Geez.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of them.
Yeah, well, that's another thing to say about it. If everybody that fishes around here and knows a little bit about akuli, opelo, and some of the things, these stocks replenish themselves so quickly, it's almost blinding speed.
Yes.
The aku, the skipjack, even though it doesn't travel well, it sure can mate and reproduce pretty well.
Yes, and, you know, there has been some concern from northern and southern countries at the edge of the skipjack range, like New Zealand, Australia, or Japan, that the catch rates there have been somewhat poor of late, and that is this example of range contraction that you get when you see, you know, a fish population under threat. The jury's still out on that. In the core of the distribution, which is the warm pool, that's that area that's surrounded by the Micronesian islands and New Guinea. There's no evidence that there's a decline in skipjack.
And they grow some pretty big aqua there. You know, they get some pretty good sized fish. You know, I think it's sort of interesting in the not recent discovery, but certainly documentation of the fact that we really do have a resident yellowfin or ahi population around the main Hawaiian islands. Yeah. It's expected that that's the case. There's something interesting about skipjack, and maybe you can explain it. That which we call aku, it's preferred by local folks for poke, because of its blood and its oil content. But for some reason, that fish doesn't travel very well. What is it? What's the scientific reason why it doesn't hold up as well as some of the other ones?
It's probably to do with the fact that it is so bloody, you know, compared to the other bigger tunas.
Yeah.
Have paler flesh compared to that really rich, you know, almost like dark chocolate.
Mm-hmm, yeah. You know, I was going to ask you, you know, when you came here years back, were you sort of surprised that, you know, here everybody says, "Oh, tumbo, I don't want it." You know, I don't want to. But that's the sought after tuna. In other parts of the world, the albacore is at the top of the food chain for cans and for people eating fish at home because they don't want the blood. It's just the opposite in the Pacific.
It always surprised me because, you know, it's a white meat tuna.
Yeah.
So it's got the tuna and all the benefits, and it's white meat.
Yeah.
You know, it's white like a cod.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's always surprised me that it's not, you know, been more popular.
I was at a big box the other day, Paul, and I was kind of pleased because there was this family in front of me, and they had the big cart, and they were shopping, and this kid grabbed the double stack of canned tuna, and the mother said, "Oh, wrong one. Get the put that one back. Get the other one." And it was albacore that was going back.
Oh, okay.
And it was just the regular. But it's a matter of taste and everything else. But it also is, I guess, in other parts of the Pacific, the albacore is small. I mean, we have some pretty big tumbo in Hawaii.
Yeah,
in comparison.
Well, the reason for that is that in The small, you only get small tumbo in cooler waters where they swim near the surface. They're vulnerable to pollen line gear, purse seining, and what was the other one? Trolling.
Yeah, I saw this really interesting setup in Oregon, and these guys were tumbo fishermen, and they had these outriggers that looked like green sticks because they had like six or so breakaway lines on each outrigger.
Right.
And they just kept going. I mean, they just kept going. And when one would break away, they just zip, they just bring it in, they just keep on going and put the hook right back out again. Very efficient.
Yeah, well, that's you know, we have somewhere between 200 and 400 vessels off the U.S. West Coast. It's, and it fishes, it, you know, out to the mid Pacific.
Yep.
There are people that have, you know, in the past had, boats in the longline fishery that have gone off and done albacore trolling themselves, you know.
Not easy. It's a big setup. You got to make a big equipment change. That being said, I was also wanted to go back again before we get back into what this closure means. Is watching this Wicked Tuna show, especially North South, or I should say Outer Banks, that spinoff, whatever it is, a much higher use of green stick. I mean, these guys are trolling with green sticks, and they use them a little differently than we do.
Mm.
You know, most of our guys have the breakaways for the rod and reel.
Yeah.
These guys have hydraulic. I mean, zip, the fish comes right in.
Okay.
Very, very, very efficient, but they use a lot of our technology. I want to make sure to take advantage of what you bring to the party every time we get to talk with you, Dr. Dovzell, and that is making people understand that there's no reason to panic here. Mm. However, there is going to be a change, at least for a little while, in the availability of fish. But then heading up towards the important time, the holidays, it's just going to maybe, I don't know, is it quality problems because of the distance they have to travel, or do you anticipate an even flow of good quality through the holidays?
Well, let's be optimistic. And if National Marine Fisheries Service gets its ducks in a row, gets the approval done, then the guys can fish You know, and as they traditionally do, there's a feeding migration of big eye that comes close to the islands around the holiday season. That means shorter trips, higher quality fish,
and more money,
and more revenue for the fishermen because the costs are lower.
Talk about the difficulty, though, in weighing what's important. I mean, because we do know that the fishing industry is this big, hungry beast. They want to catch all the fish they can. But yet there's a responsibility area. And I think most of the owners and the multiple boat owners, they're the ones that know that have the responsibility because they don't want to not be able to fish in a few years. They don't want to lose their boats.
Well, the other thing they've got to make clear here is that when they do the stock assessments, they're not just a monolithic sort of analysis. They can parse out different areas of the ocean. They can separate them out. Where we fish, where the Wai Longland fishery fishes, it has very little impact on the stock.
You know, because of the fewer number of boats and
not only that,
and the catch.
Just because we don't have purse seiners competing with us at these latitudes. So high latitude longland fisheries for big eye, again, environmentally responsible. We're tapping into elements of the stock which are not coming under pressure from concentrations of longline vessels down the and purse seiners down near the equator where the most of the fishing mortality takes place.
Why don't they come higher? Why don't the purse seiners come up?
It's wind. You know, you've got a vessel that uses a power block on a mast, and when you haul that
haul your
net in, it acts as a big sail, and so really they fish only in the horse latitudes, 10 north to 10 south, where they have light wind.
It's funny, it's not so much where the fish are, it's where the conditions are right for fishing.
And I think also that the skipjack are concentrated more towards the equator than they are in these latitudes. I mean, you can side seine. There has been that, done.
You know, it's sort of interesting because most people here that listen to the program or that are a little longer in the tooth, they remember the days of the, tuna packers and the Aku boats coming in and everything else. That's the other side of what our listeners don't understand about these purse seiners and their ability to stay out at sea for a long time and the processing ability that they have out at sea, and they don't have to bring their catch in the tuna packers and offload it and have people cut it up. This is done right there on the ships.
They don't do a huge amount of processing on the ships, but they can freeze it.
That's what I'm getting at.
They freeze it.
They can handle it to where they can make it last a long
time. And then they come into port to offload usually to a reefer vessel, which then takes it to Pango Pango.
Yeah.
Or they'll go directly to Pango Pango to drop their fish.
Sure.
But they can, they can do long voyages. They're set up. They're big boats. They're set up to do, many months at sea. Make their own water.
Yeah,
they have a. They have.
I mean, they're like little. They're like. It's like I often say. It's like traveling with your house.
Yes,
they're huge.
Yeah, beautiful. You know, in terms of the conditions on the boats, excellent.
Yeah.
You know, and
which would be indicative of they're making plenty of money to be able to upkeep that gear and keep everything in good shape.
Well, yeah, I mean, I
think they know how much to put back.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like any business. If you look at the longline fishery here, we often say that each longline boat is like a mar and par shop.
Exactly,
it has the same scale of economy.
And there's no parts department out there. There's no 7-Elevens, and you pack everything you can on these little things, and out to sea you go. You're out there for a very limited time.
Yeah,
in comparison.
And again, we point out if you had a mar and par shop and you suddenly couldn't operate for 5 months of the year, you can imagine what
you're out of business.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so that being said. As a scientist first, and then as a person in the involved at the council level like you are our boats going to be okay? I mean, this closure is impacting. It's going to impact everybody for a while.
Yeah. Optimistically, yes.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. I know you're an optimist.
But
there are challenges, right?
There are challenges. And we hope that those challenges are surmounted.
Mm-hmm.
There'll always be some boats fishing.
Sure.
At the very worst, there'll always be some boats fishing.
I've talked to some of the guys. Some of the owners that might be a little deeper in the pockets or a little bit more experienced, they just take the hit. They know when to roll. They know how to, they can trim things. But there are some people that are out there, everything's in that vessel.
Yes.
And there's no alternative. You got to go catch fish. You got to go today.
Yes. When I did an analysis of who caught how much fish in our fishery, you got these highliners, And then if you look, it was trying to describe a graph on air, it's kind of futile.
Yeah,
but there was a long tail of guys that didn't catch a lot of fish, but they're presumably in the fishery for the lifestyle.
Exactly.
And we don't want to lose those guys because, you know, each boat, you say it's a man part sort of operation. Yeah, and it's a family. And it's households. They're sending kids to school.
It may not seem like they're catching a lot.
Right.
But when you add it all up,
yeah,
there's some people that won't be able to buy fish unless they go out and catch it.
Yeah. You know? And it's like we have 140 boats in the fleet now. Mm. I would hate to see that number get halved or something because we lost a lot of the guys in the fleet who are not in it to make a fortune, but in it because they like fishing.
You know, I actually know people here in Hawaii particularly that have chosen certain lifestyles. I know some farmers. I know a lot of fishermen. Nobody's driving the latest Maserati. But they don't want it. What they really want is they just want to be able to know that they can keep the roof over their head, get a little something for mama's anniversary present, and make sure the kids have lunch money for school. They don't want much. They just want to live that life.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, we're seeing more and more of that. And I think that what we're also doing, and maybe this would be a word of encouragement that you as a scientist could give to some of the families, is if a kid is leaning towards wanting to get involved in this profession, it's an honorable one. I mean, you know, fishing and catching fish and feeding people is a pretty honorable job.
Sure. And also,
what can you do? You got to learn how, and then you got to go catch them and then take care of them.
Well, I mean, we have programs like a summer school.
Mm-hmm, I love that.
And we also have internships in our office for folks if they're interested.
And when you want to do that, you go to wpcouncil.org. There's lots of stuff you can learn there and do that. And I've had the opportunity in the past, I know you know this, Dr. Dalzell, of having some of these young people in. It's fantastic. Not only that, they think they're in for a lark, they're in for a lifetime. Once they come in and check it out, then they're in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
that's a good thing. Well, I want to thank you, as always, for spending some time with us. I think that maybe I like to, hit a home run out of the park at the end of every program and give people a reason to understand that it may be true that we have this closure and that we're living with what we've got to live with, but it also is true that in maybe a bigger picture, we're letting some of the other countries know that, hey, this little fleet in Hawaii is willing to do this. Let's duplicate what's going on here, and let's make sure that we have a level playing field going into the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good stuff. All right, Dr. Paul Dalzell. And if you want to learn a little bit more about what just happened here, easy. What you're going to do is you're going to go online to wpcouncil.org. And we'll see you again next week. Remember, if there's something you want to see on the program, or hear on the program, I should say, drop me a line, themikebuckshow@aol.com. themikebuckshow@aol.com. So for Dr. Paul Dalzell and everybody at the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, thanks for listening to Go Fish. See you next time. Aloha.